Welcome to East Meets West, episode 137. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I'm... Roger, I'm in the middle of a freak snowstorm.
Roger's acting as if he's never seen a microphone before.
We've seen it, like, emblazoned right above the microphone.
Yes, we're doing a Monday recording, which means, through the kind graces of CBS Interactive, we're using the CNET studio.
Oh, I was about to say through the duplicitous nature of Tom Merritt.
Duplicitous nature? Explain that.
I don't know.
Why are you insulting me?
I'm not. I'm just making a judgment.
I'm going to steal your co-host. You watch.
Oh, okay. Fine. Do me a favor.
Just for one video I am. And then I'll give him back. So the financial crisis is over.
No.
I'm glad we waited a day. The stock market jumped 980 some points today. Everything's fine, right?
Oh my God.
What?
Doesn't, whatever. Same yahoos that's got us in this mess are gonna, same ones are gonna get us deeper into this mess.
So how far do you think it'll drop later this week? That was the first thing I thought when I saw this huge increase.
I've always said the whole stock, it's like a bungee cord. It goes one way and it snaps back and go. It's not, I don't think it's reached its midpoint where a stabilization point.
I want to bring a graph up from like Yahoo Finance or something, because the conventional wisdom is that yes, the stock market goes up and down all the time.
Yes.
However, over time it continually rises, so that you'll end up making money if you get into the stock market, right? Like if you get in for the long term.
Yep.
So I don't know. Let me look over 10 years. It has risen over 10 years.
Yeah, partially. Part of that is just inflation.
It went way down in 2002. And, looking at it from, it's constantly rising until about 2000. And then, honestly, it looks pretty flat from 2000 on. It just doesn't seem to rise very far when you look at it, when you back it up. And I think that's what I was going to say, but I wanted to look at the graph to be sure. I feel like the stock market has leveled. It's not a place where you can just invest a bunch of money and then you'll make a bunch of money automatically, because the stock market always rises. I mean, that was true, looks like, from about 1980 through 1999, and then it's sort of level. I mean, obviously goes up and down over that time. If you compare 1999 to 2007, it went up. But now it's going back down. At the end of 1999, it was at like 11,722. Today, it's only at 98 something. 9,300, actually. So, yeah, stock market is just a market now.
I think it's always been. I think it's in some ways it's been imbued with a mythical status, which I don't think it actually deserves, because I don't know. It's an indicator, and it's a good indicator to see how markets feel, but I don't know in the long term if that will be the only way to judge.
I bring this up as an important point, because if it isn't true that the stock market over the long term will always rise, there are a lot of programs out there that need to be rethought. The idea of pensions has totally been replaced by 401k with that idea that over the long term, you will get a better return from a 401k, which is investing in the stock market, than you will from a pension plan where they just, accrue interest. And then there's this idea of privatizing Social Security and allowing people to invest their Social Security funds 401k style. Well, is that such a good idea if it's supposed to be a safety net to put it in something that is, no one has ever, whenever you get a 401k, it always says, like, there's no guarantees on your return.
Yeah, and, the thing is, even if it did go public, and there's no guarantee on that if the country itself goes bankrupt or has no money in order to pay it out. I mean, that's one of the issues with Social Security right now, is that as the boomer generation reaches that age where they can all essentially cash out, it's a tremendous amount of tax dollars that have to go into it. And unless you have an equally large group of kids coming up like below our generation to pay into our eventual retirement. I mean, the whole thing is the whole welfare system is predicated on a population pyramid where you always have an increasing growth of kids that become adults that pay into the tax system. And, you know, they would have more kids and they would pay, essentially, you know, feeding the current generation by essentially leveraging the future of the next generation.
Yeah, and that's what they're worried about with the baby boomers is you have a smaller generation behind them. And so you don't have a big Social Security account where all the money has just been sitting accruing interest.
So my thing
is... You have a ledger.
I mean, we might have to totally rethink as a society is how we deal with retirement. Is it something that you need to start thinking as soon as you roll out of high school?
Yeah.
You roll out of high school, you get a little sheet that says...
I think
says,
that's absolutely true no matter what we... No matter what happens, absolutely.
Oh, no. I think, you know, it's whether or not you agree that it's a sad facet of modern life or it's just another facet of life, that it's one of those things you kind of have to start thinking about as soon as you start earning a paycheck.
But should the stock market be the primary way in which people save for retirement? And granted, if you have a 401k at most companies, you have a choice of where to put your money. You can put it in bonds. You can put it in cash. You don't have to have that 401k money going into the stock market, but they generally provide you the most options for the stock market and sort of encourage you to, if you're young anyway, to put that money in the higher risk, higher yield investments.
I've always been kind of a medium to cautious investor, and I'll probably start doing bonds at some point. The thing is,
I've always done a stable value bond-oriented fund, at least as some portion of...
Depending whether or not the bonds don't, you know, blow it out.
Right now, everybody's like, oh, bonds and treasury securities, those are... There's no guarantee that there couldn't be some conditions sometime down the road that would make those risky.
I think you touched on it. There really is no guarantee in the long term for anything. I mean, it's one of those systems where you really have to kind of consciously make the effort... in some ways it's kind of like the grasshopper and the ants, you know, the old parable where, well, the ants were busy storing up their food stores during the summer. The grasshopper was playing along.
The grasshopper was playing the stock market. And the ants were in bonds.
I don't think it's either all stocks or no stocks. I hate to borrow a phrase. You got to diversify.
You should absolutely diversify.
You want to make sure whatever you do that.
And we are not giving financial investment advice here.
No.
We are legally not giving you advice.
Listen, a bulk of my money is in CDs. It's I don't earn.
Roger, you know, you pay $15 for a CD. When you take it back to the store, you're only going to get a couple bucks. That's a horrible way to invest your money.
Oh, Tom, you're such the jester.
You're such a wag.
You're such a funny guy. I can see why you work here. Rolling your eyes. I can hear it. It's going through.
They can't hear me rolling my eyes.
I don't know. It's the same thing. I look at people who try to invest in home, private property as a investment. And it's like, not such a good idea.
If you're not
living in it.
The good real estate advice that I always heard, even at the beginning, at the height of the boom, was don't buy a home for an investment unless you know what you're doing, unless you're a professional investor, unless you've taken classes and you understand the real estate market and the ins and outs and you know what you're getting into, you know the signs to watch for, and you're trained to do it. If you're an average person, don't buy a home as an investment. Buy it to live in.
Exactly. And even then, one of the cases is a lot of those subprime mortgages, which you had were people buying 2-3 homes because they were planning on flipping it. Right?
Yeah.
They were hedging their bets, and unfortunately, you know, they bet the wrong way and it all came crashing down.
That's the problem with it. If you're not sufficiently diversified and a professional investor, it could totally ruin you.
And then the other thing is you have a glut of homes in certain parts of the country where there are more homes and willing buyers for them, and that lowers property values because, you know, Now it's a buyer's market instead of a seller's market.
Well, and it's unusual right now is there are still places where there's urban crowding that we are having depressed property values. And I think that's an indication of just how overinflated property values were.
Yeah. And It's so complicated. There are so many nuances that, you know, I'm trying to wrap my head around. It's not one of those cases where, oh, it's the banker's fault or it's all the speculator's fault. It's it's one of those things where I've known people like you and I who are like, hey, I'm going to try to make a quick buck. And there was a lot of people with that mentality where they were trying to not game the system, but they were basically betting on making a profit. I mean, in some ways, it was no different than if you went down to the horse track to bet on a horse. You know, some people came up really well and others didn't.
It is an imaginary economy. I mean, that I actually heard one analyst saying that one of the problems was too much money was sucked out of the real economy, and the real economy being defined as the non-investment economy, the economy where you pay for goods and services in return for getting them.
Yep.
Versus the market, the stock market and the investment economy, where you're sort of betting on things.
Exactly.
You're buying a stock because you think it'll go up. You're buying a future in pork bellies, not because you want a bunch of pork bellies shipped to you, but you're betting you can sell it to somebody who does for a bigger price than you're paying right now.
And you know, that goes, that's not just, you know, it's not just property. Like, people do the same thing with collectibles. They do it with, for example, you know, classic cars, like, you know, it's an investment. It's like, it's only an investment if you can find a willing buyer to pay you that price at the end.
Well, and the point this analyst was making, where I thought was really clever, although I'm not sure I agree with him, is that this could be a very good thing for the economy because it's basically sucking all of that money back into the real economy instead of having too much in the investment economy.
I think it's actually a backhand to what I think most people assumed. And, you know, where you have inflated prices because people are each betting what they think will rise up to the top. And it's one of those self-fulfilling prophecies, right? It's like, well, you know, you better invest now in, you know, ABC, you know, funds because they're going to go up. And then everyone hears about it and they start putting money into it. And that's just kind of, you know, it's almost a self-generating kind of flow until it reaches a point where it's like, hey, look, we're not making any money. Nothing's happening. I can't sell this around. I can't turn it around. And that's when people's like, oh, well, I better pull in my money. So,
oh, it is funny, too. Gold made a big run up during this recent downturn. Oh. And I even bought some recently after it made a dive back down.
Uh-huh.
But then today, when the market went up 1,000 points practically, gold took a hit. And the reason it took a hit was everyone was like, oh, the market's back. I'm going to get rid of my gold. Don't need to have that hedge fund. Gold tends to, I mean, if you want something that you can look at it going all the way back to the 30s on a constant marching rise just ahead of inflation, you got gold.
Yeah.
It doesn't, I mean, it spikes like everything else. It goes way up, it goes way down. But over the long term, it marches very steadily. But you see these people, and the reason it goes up and down in the short term is because people aren't thinking long term. They don't say, like, you know what, I need a nice hedge fund for my, you know, against the future, a little safe fund. I'm going to buy some gold. They think, oh my gosh, the sky's falling. Go to gold. Oh, wait, everything, the sky's going back up. Dump my gold.
It's my gold.
I don't know. Even gold, if you think about it, like, what are the inherent properties in gold that make it so valuable outside of being able to use it in, say, electronics where it's a good malleable?
Rarity, malleability, and endurability. Those are the three things has been explained to me as why gold is an actual valuable commodity, because it's malleable. You can work it into things, make things out of it, but it's durable. It doesn't wear away fast and it's rare. So there are plenty of things that all fit those first two descriptions,
moon rocks,
but they're not necessarily.
Should I invest in moon rocks?
And it's pretty.
I should invest in moon rocks.
Gold is pretty. Hey, if you can. Moon rocks are very bad. In fact, I think it's against the law to trade in moon rocks, is it not?
Is it? Oh.
I don't know. They always see them up for sale in the back of the comic books, but I always figured that was fake.
Well, I've seen people sell moon rocks before.
Yeah.
Like, it's, you know, it's...
Are they malleable, though?
So, water from the moon, then? Put in an airtight container and trade water?
Yeah, but water's on the moon would be water here. I mean, there's really no difference. That's a collectability thing there.
Uh-huh.
Gold, I think, has some real intrinsic value to it.
Yeah,
at least more so than water from the moon.
Platinum.
Yeah, well, platinum is even more rare. Has similar properties and is more valuable.
Invest in platinum.
Yeah, why not? that's a good idea. No, I'm just kidding.
Let's build a home out of it. You know, and I'll put all the extra bars under my bed.
Remember, this is not investment advice. We're getting even farther from investment advice the more we talk about it.
I don't know. It's kind of weird. It's You also understand, y'all also understand how interconnected all these markets are. You know, as soon as the big banks hit, you know, the German finance minister came out and kind of smugly said, well, this is the end of the American superpower status.
Oh, right, yeah.
And the week later, he's out figuring out a bailout for German banks.
I think we at East Meets West are against overreaction in any form.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, you know, one of the things that came out of the post-World War II conflict was the fact that the U.S. dollar became a reserve currency, and that was in some way to stabilize currencies in post-World War Europe, and some people were speculating that the euro might become the new reserve currency. I don't know. When push came to shove, a lot of those countries started acting independently of the ECB over a unified European approach. I mean, Iceland took a loan from the Russians to cover a bank that was three times greater than the national GDP or the GDP of Iceland.
Oh, really?
I mean,
they took it from Russia?
They took, yeah.
I knew they took a loan. I didn't realize
from Russia. Well, yeah. They got turned down by the EU, got turned down by the U.S., and they got turned down by the Scandinavian countries.
No, low credit, no credit, no problem. The Russian bank is open for you.
Come to Uncle Putin's loan. You know, it'll be interesting to how this all shakes out. Whether or not, you know, there will be continued slumping in global markets. In some ways, the fact that China and India have pretty sizable middle class demographics could help cushion, but, you know, remains. I mean, it's one of those things that you can predict, but, you know, anything goes, I think, right now.
I really didn't feel like the bottom of the market had been hit yet on Friday, but I did feel like there would be a jump on Monday. The thing is, I didn't think the jump this Monday would be this big, because when you're talking about predicting the market, you're talking about predicting psychology.
Exactly.
And so it's an exact science, as is economics. People forget that.
No, totally.
I do think that the market will go back down. Now I'm not so sure it's going to go all the way down to the 7,800 or so that I thought it was going to. But I definitely think it's going to take another dip, another big dip, before it recovers and stabilizes.
And one of the things is the credit crunch is that all these banks are now scared of loaning money to each other.
Yeah, and that credit crunch is not solved yet.
No.
That's why I think there's going to be another dip, because there's going to be another scare.
And, you know, the thing is, especially with a lot of companies that need that borrow money for short-term things like paydays, infrastructure work and stuff like that. I mean, how are they going to do that? I mean,
just like when you go down to the cash box and get a payroll loan against your paycheck in advance, companies do exactly the same thing, except to pay you that paycheck that you got a loan against.
Yeah.
Cashbox is in trouble.
I know.
Because those paychecks aren't going to come pretty soon. Then we got bread lines.
Maybe. I don't think it'll be... You know, it'll be interesting to see if a new informal economy will spring up to cover that or not.
All right, let's deal with at least one comment off the blog, subreddit.com/EMW. Of course, there are plenty of great comments. If you wanted to jump in, go there and post your comments regarding each episode. Keith says, in 136, both of you were criticizing the desire for a Washington outsider as president. The comparison was made to having a lawyer act as a doctor. This analogy does not stand up, as they are two completely separate fields. You could instead compare a Washington insider, invoking a negative connection, to an HMO executive or a pharmaceutical rep. These people have a vested interest that is likely not yours. I see longtime senators as tangled in a web of allegiances, many times to pass bills. The you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours mentality is employed. This is why so much pork is allowed to pass. The same reason is why campaign finance reform is so difficult to ever pass. It is in very few politicians' interest to see a change. Also, this tendency to like governors is apparent since Bush and Clinton were both outsiders. George H.W. Bush had House experience, but that had probably little to do with his election. Going back, Ford had legislative experience, but he was never elected. That means the last president elected with serious congressional experience was Nixon in 1968.
Just correction. I never said I was against Washington outsiders. I said that there needs to be a balance.
Yeah, and that's why Keith makes very good points here. And yes, there are problems with Washington, but I think the way to fight them is not to just complain about how all these Washington insiders are ruining everything. I think you have to go after the people who are doing the pork barrel, the people who are using the having the undue influence as a voter. And
you
that's
mean,
a sociological
you mean,
issue.
Do you mean special interest groups? Or?
Everybody's against the Washington insiders until it comes to theirs.
Yes.
I mean, that's the problem.
Well,
is
I mean,
you look at the people you vote for in your district, they're not Washington insiders. They're your representative that you like, and you vote them back yeah. in year after, you know, term after
and
term after term.
And when they bring in public projects or they bring investment, it's not considered pork barreling.
No,
it's good for you.
Then, then you're taking care of the constituency.
And see, well, see, there's an issue. People talk about special interest like it's this kind of all-encompassing yet vague group of people out there to screw you over. The problem is special interest groups cover everything from the Sierra Club to petroleum, you know, companies
to medical doctors,
medical
nurses,
doctors,
labor unions,
teacher unions. So those are all special interests. So when you say you're against special interest, are you also against your, you know,
you are a member of a special interest
yeah,
in some way.
Exactly.
If you look at it closely and honestly enough.
So it's, I think it's,
people are not against special interest. They're against the special interests that don't help them.
Exactly.
And I think that's a fine point. Now, I don't disagree with what Keith said, but I do say what Roger said is we're talking about a balance here. I think it is just as ridiculous to say, no Washington insiders. If you're a Washington insider, you're awful and we hate you. That's silly. You need people who know how government works to govern. You don't want to have somebody totally inexperienced. On the other side, you're right. Washington insiders can often be more interested in making the system work for them than they are for making the system work for you. And so that's what needs that. We've identified the problem. Yeah. How do you fix that? You don't fix it by just saying only inexperienced people should be elected. And you don't fix it by just letting everybody who's always been in Washington stay in Washington.
Now, do you believe, quick question, do you believe in term limits?
I don't.
No,
I don't. And I'm an idealist there. And I know I'm probably wrong, but I don't believe in term limits because I think the electorate should be able to vote in whoever they want. If they find the perfect, beneficent person who
yep.
is free of all interests and is president, they should be president as long as they are capable and the electorate is willing to elect them. I think that's the voice of democracy there. However, I totally understand the practical benefits of term limits because of this. The psychological thing
yep.
is people tend to vote for incumbents because they're familiar with them.
You know, I've been thinking about the idea of having on and off again where you can do so many years back to back and then you have to step down and
yeah.
you come back in.
Or maybe the House of Representatives is the place where no one can ever serve a term twice.
Maybe.
Because it's you're representing the people and so everyone needs a turn to represent the people.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
And the thing is, you know, I mean, it's idealistic notion to say a lot of things and practically speaking, there are certain things that we do. For example, freedom of speech, we do, idealistically, there's a lot of things we enshrine in that. But, you know, practically, you can't incite people to violence. You can't yell fire.
Can't yell fire in a crowded theater.
So there's a lot of give and take because you also have to deal with the human mentality
yeah.
of being, you know, jerks. So, I mean,
or ignorant.
Or both.
And I don't mean that as an epithet. I mean that in a technical meaning,
yeah.
unaware of certain facts.
Yeah. So, you know, it's maybe you need a system where you can, you know, granted you might not get the immediate benefits, but in the long term, it enables a smoother operation.
Smooth operator. All right. That's it for us. Thanks for listening. Subrilliant.com/EMW to make your comments for the next episode.
Get more people to listen.
Bye.